Good evening, everyone. Welcome. All right. Thank you for attending this event. Really appreciate it on a late, cold London evening. My name is Aaron McKeel. I'm the course tutor on the Executive Masters in International Strategy and Diplomacy program at LSE Ideas. Quite pleased to be invited to chair this event this evening. We are exploring a quite serious topic, though. The potential of a new Euro-missile crisis, quite concerning, the implications of the dissolution of the INF Treaty. Quite serious questions arise around this topic, where the new weapons are being deployed and what kind of disorders afoot in Europe and abroad. It's quite serious conversation that we'll explore. But this event is also about the launch of a new online resource for UK peace activism in the 1980s. It's actually a quite fantastic resource, lovely little thing that I have been exploring today. I've seen it on Twitter as well, making the rounds, new images. Please do explore it and make use of it if you can. That is a peace and security project at LSE Ideas in partnership with Open University and with generous funding from LSE Knowledge Exchange and Impact Fund. We have a hashtag for this evening, as we do, LCINF. Please feel free to use that if you wish. We have three quite good speakers for this event, I think. I think it's a good range of expertise. First, we have Luc-André Brunet. He's a lecturer at Open University in 20th century history. He's also the director of the Peace and Security Project at LSE Ideas. His current research is about intranatal relations and peace activism in Canada as well as elsewhere in the early 1980s. We also have Kate Hudson to his right, the General Secretary of the Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament, a leading anti-nuclear and anti-war campaigner in the UK and internationally. I'm quite pleased to have her with us this evening. He's also the author of CND at 60, subtitled Britain's Most Enduring Mass Movement. Lastly, we have Sam Duden, a UK Nuclear Policy Research Fellow at the Royal United Services Institute, RUSI. His portfolio includes work on the UK Project on Nuclear Issues, as well as trilateral nuclear dialogues. He's an expert in UK nuclear policy and weapons as well in general. We have 15 minutes for each speaker. We'll go in that order. This is a podcast recorded, so we'll do questions at the end. Please wait for the microphone so we can catch you on the podcast. All right, thank you. Luke, over to you.
Thanks very much. Great, so thanks very much, Aaron, for that introduction, for chairing. And to all of you for coming to discuss a very important issue this evening. So it's no exaggeration. So it's no exaggeration to say that the INF Treaty was one of the most important international agreements of the entire Cold War. So for the first time in history, it abolished an entire class of nuclear weapons. And furthermore, it closed an important chapter in the history of the Cold War. So the early 1980s were a period of heightened tensions between the Eastern and Western camps in the Cold War, sometimes referred to as the Second Cold War, to use the term popularized by LSE's own Fred Halliday from the IR department. So for the UK, the INF Treaty has a particular importance. In the autumn of 1983, at the height of this so-called Second Cold War, INF, or Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces, more specifically, cruise missiles, were deployed at two RAF bases in England, Molesworth and Greenham Common. And the INF Treaty, signed in December 1987, led directly to the removal of these cruise missiles from the UK. And as a result, the only nuclear weapons in the UK today are the UK's own continuous at-sea deterrent, Trident. And one of the most worrying questions about the end of the INF Treaty is whether this could see a return of INF to European and particularly to British soil. In my talk this evening, I'd like to provide a short historical account of how and why INF came to be deployed in Britain in the first place in the 1980s and the consequences of this decision. And then we'll look at how the INF Treaty brought about the removal of these same missiles from the UK. So this should provide us with the necessary historical context to discuss how far we might expect a kind of return to the situation that existed before and indeed was brought to an end by the INF Treaty. And to illustrate the situation in the 1980s, I'd like to use a brand new online resource that we're launching today, as Aaron mentioned, and that we've developed here at the LSC in collaboration with the Open University. So the archives of CND are housed here at LSC, at LSC Library, and we've been able to digitize a selection of them, which are now freely available online and organized around six different themes. We've also added video interviews with academics, peace activists, and policymakers. And you'll see some of the images from this new online collection in the slides that I'm using this evening. But I'd encourage you all to explore this further on the LSC Ideas website as part of the Peace and Security Project. And you can see the URL at the bottom there. And also, I'd just like to thank a couple of people before getting started with my talk. So first of all, I'd like to thank Daniel Payne and Neil Stewart at the LSC Library for all their work on this project, as well as Jess Keating at LSC Ideas, who actually built all the web pages, as well as James Ratty, who made all the videos. And finally, Irina Karamuzi of the University of Sheffield, with whom I co-direct the Peace and Security Project at LSC Ideas. So the first question we might ask is why cruise missiles were deployed at all in the UK in the 1980s. And to answer this, I think we need to look at the international developments in the preceding decade. So the 1970s were a period of détente, of relaxation of international tensions between the US and Soviet-led blocs in the Cold War. And this decade saw some important arms control treaties, notably the Strategic Arms Limitation Treaty, or SALT, or SALT I, and the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaties, both of which were signed in 1972 by Nixon and Brezhnev, who we see here. And these treaties limited the use and the expansion of certain categories of nuclear weapons. But both superpowers, of course, continued to develop new weapon systems. And in 1976, the Soviets deployed a new kind of missile, the SS-20, in Eastern Europe. And the SS-20 was an example of INF, meaning it had a range of between 500 and 5,500 kilometers. So why does its range matter? Well, it meant that the Soviets had deployed new weapons in Eastern Europe, which were capable of hitting targets in Western Europe, but not in the United States. And this upset the strategic balance of nuclear weapons in Europe. So ideally, both sides would have roughly comparable levels of nuclear weapons, as this effectively, or more effectively, deters either side from trying to use them. Things get rather more dangerous when there's a perceived imbalance on one side or the other. So in response to these SS-20s, NATO adopted a policy in December 1979 known as the dual-track decision. So on the one hand, or on the one track, arms control negotiations would continue to try and secure the removal of the SS-20s from Eastern Europe. So this would restore the strategic balance at the original lower levels. On the other hand, or the second track, NATO would plan on deploying its own INF in Western Europe, which would be capable of hitting targets in the Soviet Union, to counter the SS-20s. So this would similarly restore the strategic balance, but now at higher levels. And concretely, this meant that several Western European governments had to agree to have new American nuclear weapons stationed on their soil. And in the event, five European governments agreed to do so, those of West Germany, Italy, the Netherlands, Belgium, and, of course, the United Kingdom. So the Conservative government, Margaret Thatcher, agreed to deploy American cruise missiles at two sites in England, and deployments were due to begin in the autumn of 1983. And the early 1980s, as I mentioned a moment ago, saw a worsening of relations between the Soviet bloc and NATO. And these tensions were exacerbated by the dual-track decision, and particularly by the arrival in January 1981 of President Reagan in the White House. So Reagan pursued a hardline approach against the Soviet Union, which he infamously labeled the evil empire that would end up on the ash heap of history. So against this backdrop, negotiations to have the SS-20s removed stalled, and deployment of the so-called Euromissiles went ahead. Now this policy decision to deploy ground-launched cruise missiles on UK soil sparked an unprecedented public response. Although peace and anti-nuclear groups had existed for decades in the UK and elsewhere, the prospect of having new nuclear weapons placed on British soil highlighted fears of a new nuclear arms race between the two Cold War camps and the horrors of nuclear war. Perhaps the most iconic image we have of the UK peace movement during this period is that of the women's peace camp at Greenham Common, which was one of the two military bases where cruise missiles were to be deployed. So opposition to the stationing of INF in the UK could also be seen in massive demonstrations organised by the CND and other groups. So the biggest of these, held in October 1983, gathered over 300,000 people in Hyde Park. And peace groups were also active in lobbying MPs, public education campaigns, and so on. Now, it's important to point out here that the public response to cruise missiles in the UK and the rise of the peace movement here was part of a much bigger international phenomenon. So huge peace demonstrations were organized, notably in the United States and West Germany, and women's peace camps inspired by Greenham Common were set up from Comiso, Sicily, to Cold Bay, Saskatchewan. And many of the campaign themes, slogans, and publications produced by the UK peace movement were adopted elsewhere in the world. So you can see here an image of a peace rally in 1983. Can anyone guess where this was held? Those of you with very good vision can maybe read it. But this is actually in Toronto, in Canada. But among the signs, we can read Refuse the Cruise, which of course was a CND slogan. And in smaller font, we can see Protest and Survive, which is the name of a famous pamphlet by the UK activist E.P. Thompson. So we can see how these ideas were circulating internationally at the time, and how opposition to the threat of nuclear war was mobilizing citizens around the world. And this widespread opposition to the stationing of nuclear missiles in Western Europe came to be known as the Euromissile Crisis. And one of the defining features of the Euromissile Crisis is the scale of public opposition and action taken against the decision. And this was not expected by NATO leaders in 1979, and it came as a very unwelcome surprise to NATO governments. Now, the large-scale public opposition to Euromissiles presented NATO governments with a very real challenge. It's very hard to argue against peace. And one of the consequences of this widespread peace movement was that it forced governments to explain their policies and to justify them. So in addition to this kind of public relations response of explaining their policies, the UK government, or more specifically the Conservative Party, pursued other means of countering the peace movement. So they set up several campaign groups with names like the Coalition for Peace Through Security, with the aim of producing materials which directly attacked the peace movement. So for example, the CND had produced a widely read pamphlet, which you can see here, called 30 Questions and Answers About CND. The Coalition for Peace Through Security produced their own pamphlet, made to look nearly identical to the original, but entitled 30 Questions and Honest Answers About CND. So they kept the same 30 questions, but provided decidedly different answers. To the question, does the CND believe in change by violence, for example, the original pamphlet states categorically, no. The alternative pamphlet instead answers ominously, not so far. So we can see this is perhaps an early version of Fact Checked UK. And two themes dominated these materials, as we can see from these two posters. So one was the allegation that the UK peace movement was effectively a Soviet front. So here we can see Stalin holding a mask with the caption, who's behind these so-called peace movements? So not terribly subtle. And another tactic was trying to associate the peace movement of the 1980s with the pacifist movement of the 1930s, and particularly the policy of appeasement towards Nazi Germany. So in this image we see Brezhnev apparently joking with Hitler about how naive the British are for supporting the peace movement. Now, all of this was meant to discredit the peace movement and its arguments, particularly ahead of the 1983 general election. In that election, of course, Labour backed unilateral disarmament, but they were defeated by the Conservatives, which meant that INF deployment proceeded in the autumn of 1983. Now, just as citizens of the UK and other countries were increasingly worried about the possibility and the consequences of nuclear war, we now know, thanks to the opening up of the archives, just how far similar questions were being considered by world leaders as well. So in November 1983, just days before the cruise missiles arrived at Greenham Common, Margaret Thatcher told another NATO leader, quote, One has to remember that things were growing again 1 year after Hiroshima was attacked. That same month, in November 1983, the Chinese premier, Deng Xiaoping, predicted that nuclear war would break out in the next 5 to 10 years. But he explained that it would not be the end of the human race. 2 billion of the world's population of 4 billion at the time might die in nuclear war, but 2 billion would be left. And the Soviet Union and the USA would make up a rather larger proportion of the 2 billion killed. In relative terms, he concluded, China would fare better than the superpowers in a nuclear war. Now, these statements are pretty bleak, even downright terrifying, but it shows just how far world leaders were contemplating nuclear war. In the early and mid-1980s, this was seen as a very real possibility. It was clearly not the desired outcome, even of the most hawkish world leaders, but it was one that had to be taken very seriously. Now, in the mid-1980s, two important developments took place within the superpowers. So in November 1984, Ronald Reagan was re-elected for a second term as president. And while in his first term, he had clearly pursued an aggressive stance against the USSR, by 1984, Reagan had adopted a more conciliatory approach in many respects. Some historians have termed this the Reagan reversal, from the staunch anti-communist of his first term to the more conciliatory leader who managed to reach agreements, such as the INF Treaty, with the Soviets. Perhaps even more important was the arrival in March 1985 of Mikhail Gorbachev as leader of the Soviet Union. So Gorbachev was much more enthusiastic than his immediate predecessors about nuclear arms control. And Reagan and Gorbachev held summits in Geneva and Reykjavik in 1985-86, where they managed to build a degree of rapport and mutual trust. And this paved the way for the INF Treaty of December 1987, which of course led to the removal of INF from Europe and to the end of the Euromissile crisis. So to conclude, I'd like to suggest three lessons from the Euromissile crisis that might help us evaluate whether INF could return to Europe in the years ahead. So first, it's important to remember that INF deployment came at the request of European governments who felt their security was threatened. So this was not something imposed by the United States on Europe. So similarly, a precondition of any new INF deployment in Europe would be that European NATO members felt it was essential for their own security vis-a-vis Russia. So while this may not necessarily apply to the UK, it's perhaps more likely to be the case in countries bordering Russia, such as the Baltic states, particularly since the 2014 invasion of Ukraine by Russia. Second, as our discussion of the UK peace movement suggests, governments are responsive to public opinion on these questions. So NATO governments did not expect the degree of widespread opposition to INF deployment, and it's debatable whether all five of those Western European governments that agreed in 1979 to deploy them would have reached the same decision had they known the degree of public opposition that would follow. So governments today would know full well that similar deployments would meet with mass opposition, which would certainly factor into their decision-making. And finally, when it comes to nuclear arms control, it's important to remember that individual leaders matter enormously. The fact that the INF was signed at all is down in large part to the two individuals leading the superpowers at that specific point in time. So it's doubtful whether Gorbachev's immediate predecessors, Chernyenko or Andropov, for example, would have reached such an agreement. And we've seen more recently how the actions of a single leader can make all the difference. So President Trump, of course, has withdrawn the US from a bilateral treaty covering INF, as well as from multilateral ones, such as the Iran nuclear deal, which have raised new questions about nuclear non-proliferation. So a change in leadership, whether in the US, in Russia, or in other countries, can have significant consequences for nuclear arms control. But I think I'll end there and hand over to our next speaker. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Okay, well, thanks very much for coming along this evening. Can I thank the LSE for hosting this discussion, and particular thanks to Luke for producing such a fantastic resource about peace protests. And of course, as you said, we're very delighted that our archives are housed here at the LSE, and they're a fantastic resource. So if any of you are researching or studying or just even interested in the issue, please do visit. It's really a fantastic collection. So I'm going to talk about quite a lot of the things that Luke's been covering, but from a slightly different perspective. So I'm going to be covering it from the perspective of the peace movement itself, and then also bringing things up to date a little bit and giving something of our assessment of what's going on in the world at the moment. So starting though back in the late 1970s, we assessed it at the time that the US had changed its strategy following the defeat in Vietnam. This was a very, very big development. The superpower had been defeated by a kind of rural army, let's say. But the impact of that defeat lasted a very, very long time, even into the 21st century. In other words, they would no longer engage in large-scale military interventions with troops on the ground, which meant that their young service personnel would come back in body bags. This was a real thing from the 1970s that was known as Vietnam Syndrome. People did not want to see those bodies coming off the planes in the bags. And, of course, that affected their policies even up until the Iraq War in the early part of this century. Now, this meant a number of things. It meant, for example, if you think about what was going on in the 1970s, that the United States could not directly confront national liberation movements or the radical movements that were in the ascendancy in many countries at that time. But they could perhaps put pressure on the Soviet Union to erode its capacity to support them. Okay, so they weren't going to send troops there to knock out these movements, but they could put pressure on the Soviet Union, which did give material and financial support for a lot of these liberation movements. So the kind of idea that the Soviet Union could be pressed to step up its arms spending and its military nuclear spending to somehow distract and withdraw money and support from their other international enterprises. Some people, of course, say that the intention was to bankrupt the Soviet Union through a new arms race. And, of course, if you look at what happened to the Soviet economy as a result of this kind of spending, perhaps there's some truth in that. So some examples of this new approach. President Carter's neutron bomb, for example. Now, we don't tend to hear much about the neutron bomb because the protest about it in the 1970s was so enormous that the countries, the leaders of the West European countries, decided that they did not wish to take it. So they told the US leadership they weren't going to have the neutron bomb. It was described by many people at the time as the kind of ultimate capitalist weapon, but it didn't destroy buildings and property. It killed people, civilians, through radiation poisoning. There was also an increase in NATO budgets. Reagan began his Star Wars program. Some of you may remember that. That was the forerunner of the missile defense program, which, of course, is such a thorny issue now in the last decade or so in terms of US-Russia bilateral reductions and so on around the New START treaty. The missile defense developments has been a big issue there. And then, of course, most important for our discussion this evening, the deployment of cruise and Pershing missiles in Europe. And as Luke has pointed out, this turn in US policy provoked the biggest demonstrations that have taken place against nuclear weapons in history, and in Europe, the biggest demonstrations at all since the end of the Second World War. So it did indeed provoke enormous protests. And that was because it was understood very widely that cruise and Pershing missiles could lead to nuclear war in Europe. That was something that at the time we all understood, and it was that fear which drove the scale of the mobilization. In 1979, Yes, it was backed by West European leaders. Sometimes Margaret Thatcher's given the blame for accepting cruise missiles here, but in actual fact it was Jim Callaghan, prior to Mrs. Thatcher coming to office, who accepted the cruise missiles, and of course Chancellor Schmidt in Germany as well. So they accepted that they would be located in Western Europe from 1983 onwards, and then leaders of other countries that eventually housed them also agreed too. So what it meant for us here was 160 cruise missiles coming to the UK. 96 would go to Greenham, and they were due to arrive in December 1983, and 64 would go to Molesworth Base at the end of 1986. Now, I listened carefully to what Luke said about the strategic balance and so on. We have never shared that perspective. Our view is that this was indeed an escalation of the arms race, because it greatly reduced the time it took to hit Soviet cities like Moscow from bases in Western Europe. So it brought Moscow very much into a much more rapid targeting situation. And there was no equivalent sighting of Soviet missiles in proximity to US cities. So that it kind of broke the strategic balance by kind of loading those missiles in closer proximity to Moscow. And our argument at the time was that the sighting of the Soviet SS-20s was used as a justification, but because they couldn't hit the USA, the generally given argument wasn't really a kind of true argument. So huge mobilizations took place across West European countries. That's an example of some of the protests in the Netherlands, and hundreds, literally hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people were involved in those protests. I'm going to focus on Britain, but Germany in particular. I don't have any photos of Germany, but the protests there really shaped the politics of the 1980s in Germany and left a very lasting legacy of peaceful orientation in German foreign policy. Now, how did we feel at the time? Well, we felt that we would be targets. We felt that a nuclear war was going to be fought in Europe that wouldn't affect the United States. This terrible fear wasn't only expressed through the protests that took place, but also through popular culture at the time as well. I don't know if you've ever seen the film Threads, for example, which is absolutely terrifying, based on a nuclear weapon being dropped on Sheffield. I mean, there were lots of nuclear weapons being dropped, but the kind of very human story was based on a family in Sheffield and how they experienced it. There was the very famous comic book, very serious, you know, cartoon book, When the Wind Blows, about an old couple suffering from the consequences of radiation poisoning and so on. So it was kind of imbued within our culture and our understanding of what was going on, the terrors of this. So just to show a few, so we saw one from Luke, but that's again the protest and survive. That was a pamphlet, as you said, that was produced to counter the British government's protect and survive, the idea that you could get under the kitchen table or cover your windows with whitewash or brown paper or something, you'd be protected from this. So it was a kind of response to that. Again, protest and survive, no cruise missiles. So many massive demonstrations, you know, the largest, it was only in 2003, the big demonstrations against the Iraq war, that any demonstration actually came close or surpassed that. Europe nuclear-free zone, not nuclear battle zone, halt American cruise missiles, you know, massive mobilization. All kinds of local groups sprang up. I mean, that was one of the interesting things for CND at that time. At the end of the 70s, it was a relatively small organization. It was described by one of our former chairs, Bruce Kent, as the shoebox years, because all the membership cards could be fitted in one shoebox. Well, within a year or two of the announcement of cruise missiles, we had hundreds, literally hundreds of thousands of members, and little new groups were springing up, anti-missiles groups, all across the country, in just in streets even, High Street against the missiles and so on, Merseyside Action for Peace, masses and masses of local organisations developing. And they were all kind of embraced by CND, the kind of a spontaneous movement that it embraced. And of course, Greenham Common, not organised by CND, but autonomously organised by women's peace groups, but supported by CND. That's a picture from a day in December 82, I think it was, Embrace the Base, where 35,000 women came to Greenham Common to embrace the base. That's a kind of blockading, lovely blockading picture. But Greenham wasn't the only one. Of course, as we said, the missiles were also due in 1986 to go to Molesworth. That's Molesworth. So, sometimes confrontation with the police. That's, Michael Heseltine was Defence Secretary at the time, so he was very, very hostile to the peace camp and so on, all the peace stuff, so that's a kind of image of him. But there was great creativity as well amongst the protesters. And then, of course, goodbye cruise. So a very, very rapid reaction, because, of course, the situation internationally was changing very rapidly at the same time. But unlike Luke, rather than put an emphasis on the individuals, and, of course, the role of Gorbachev was important, but the role of the mass protests, we think, was very, very significant, in particular in helping to shape the US response. You know, one of the things about Reagan, when he came to the end of his first term in office, he was advised by his top people, you know, you can't go on like this or you're going to lose the election. You know, there was such an upsurge of opposition within the United States. So that helped to shape his policy. And then, of course, as a result, yes, a similar photo to yours, I think. So that was the moment when the INF Treaty was signed in December 1987. And it was indeed the first nuclear disarmament treaty which did actually get rid of nuclear weapons. And everything was gone by 1991. I mean, it was a quite remarkable development how rapidly that came about. However, things have changed somewhat. So the current leaders of those two great states, superpowers. So we have a very new scenario, and I would characterize it particularly in two ways. One is Trump's orientation to withdrawing from treaties or multilateral treaties and agreements. In this area, of course, it's not only in the area of peace and nuclear weapons that he's withdrawn from treaties. There's also the climate change treaty, the Trans-Pacific Partnership. He's pulled out of the UNHRC and so on. So that's a kind of an orientation, perhaps best summed up by the attitudes of George Bolton, who Trump obviously is now no longer enamoured of, so he's out of office, but he really encapsulated that hawkish anti-multilateralism that the Trump administration enshrines. So the two most dangerous withdrawals from Trump are obviously the INF Treaty, but also from the Iran nuclear deal. So we haven't got time to go into that, but that's a very significant withdrawal from a bilateral agreement. One of the dangers that we've highlighted with the withdrawal from the INF Treaty is that it may indicate that the United States will not now go on to renew the New START Treaty or produce a successor treaty to the New START Treaty, which comes to an end in 2021. And if that happens, there will be really no restraint, no actual treaty restraint anymore on the development of nuclear disarmament or arms reductions in that field. So it's a very dangerous situation. And it's made even more so if you take this anti-treaty and anti-multilateral approach alongside some of the policies which Trump has introduced over the last couple of years. And I'm just going to very quickly mention two of those. In 2018, the beginning of that, the Nuclear Posture Review, Trump's Nuclear Posture Review, which was introduced at that time. This was characterized by two very alarming developments. Firstly, the talk of the introduction of so-called usable low-yield nuclear weapons. Now, the general consensus globally since 1945 is that they will never be used again. That's been the kind of underpinning idea. And the nuclear weapon states, by and large, have been held together in the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, where there's a kind of, at least a kind of nominal agreement that there won't be proliferation and there will be disarmament. But Trump has kind of broken with that perspective and talked about usable, low-yield nuclear weapons. And the policy also outlined more scenarios for the use of nuclear weapons. So this is incredibly dangerous developments, and in fact, manufacture of those new nuclear weapons began earlier this year at a facility in Texas. Now, if you take that policy together with Trump's national security strategy, I think the situation has become even more dangerous. Within this security strategy, there's a kind of move away from the orientation towards the Middle East and the so-called war on terror towards a focus on Russia and China, describing them as revisionist powers seeking to reshape the world in their own authoritarian image. And within that, they talk about the importance of maintaining US dominance, global dominance, and being ready to win a major war. Okay, so that sounds like a moving away from the Vietnam syndrome towards the possibility of a major mass war against Russia or China. So, a very, very dangerous situation. And of course, everyone hopes, I'm sure, that it's possible for negotiations and diplomacy to be reasserted and ensure that new treaties come forward to take the place of the old one. Finally, then, just to say a word about where such new missiles would be located. This is the big question, really. And for us, obviously, would they come back to the United Kingdom? That's a key question, given our experience in the 1980s. Well, of course, it's possible. If there are going to be cruise successor missiles targeted on Russia, yes, possibly they could be located in the United Kingdom. Some people, of course, think it's more likely that they would be located in Eastern Europe. It's closer in proximity to Russia, and the states, the governments in Eastern Europe have been very strongly pro-NATO. They're new NATO member states, and they would not have the same level of opposition to the sighting of these missiles in those countries as they would if they were likely to be put here. So I think that that's a very distinct likelihood that they would go further east, because whereas it used to be SS-20s in Eastern Europe, now it's open to US or NATO cruise missiles. But then, of course, the other likely area, of course, is for missiles that are aimed at China. And I think this is probably what analysts will consider to be the greatest likelihood and the greatest risk, the possibility or the probability that the US will be putting them in East Asia in order to assert its Pacific dominance and to prevent a further rise of China in that region. Where would they put them? Some people might say, well, why wouldn't they put them in Guam? But of course, the thought is that Guam is already very heavily targeted. So two possible scenarios that I've seen mentioned are the location in Japan's Ryukyu Islands or in the Republic of Palau in Micronesia. So there are kind of base opportunities for the United States to put these new missiles into East Asia to intervene in the sort of developing Chinese sphere of influence and to ensure that in line with their national security strategy, they do retain their global dominance. So as you can imagine, we're going to be busy protesting. So we did have this was earlier this year when the treaty was going to, they were going to pull out of the treaty. That was 10 days to save the INF treaty. Unfortunately, that didn't happen. Some of you may recognise the characters on either side. The guy on the left, that's Fabian Hamilton, who's Labour's shadow minister for disarmament. And that's Lloyd Russell Moyle, MP, who sometimes does spectacular things in the House of Commons. And then we had an action lobbying government. As Luke mentioned, I think throughout the years we've had strong lobbying of governments. And then that was a card that we produced, don't let Trump trash the INF treaty. And tens of thousands of those cards were signed by members and supporters, and we gave those in to the Foreign Office. Unfortunately, unlike many of the European governments, which tried to urge the United States to stay within the INF Treaty, Britain did not take that position. And indeed, our Defence Select Committee, I thought, produced a rather reprehensible apology in the form of a review or sort of summary thing of support for Trump's position. So that's unfortunate. But whatever happens with the developments of crews and so on, we will be there to oppose them. Thank you very much.
If you wish, yes. Hi, my name is Sam Doodin. I'm the UK Nuclear Policy Research Fellow at RUSI, and I used to work as a strategic analyst in the Ministry of Defence for about a decade. So I'm going to be talking about how the strategic situation during the Euro missiles crisis is quite different in four main ways from the strategic situation we have today, and why I don't think it's likely that you're going to see a rerun of the Euro missiles crisis. Firstly, regarding conventional military strength, NATO was weaker than the Soviet Union during the Euro missiles crisis. This meant that NATO militaries and NATO governments are placing a lot more emphasis on their nuclear forces in order to compensate for their conventional weakness vis-a-vis the USSR. This means they are particularly vulnerable to arguments about escalation gaps. So basically, escalation gap arguments go as follows. Escalation ladders exist. Herman Kahn, 1965, outlines 44 levels in his escalation ladder. The lowest level, you have political, economic, and diplomatic gestures. At the highest level, you have total war and a full exchange targeting population centers with all your nuclear forces and targeting the military as well. And in between those extremes, you have various levels of escalation. So during the Cold War, there's a lot of talk about escalation gaps, which exists when one side can escalate to a certain level within those 44 levels and the other side can't because it doesn't have the capability to do that. So hypothetically speaking, if you had two countries, country A and country B, country A only has strategic nuclear weapons and country B has tactical and strategic nuclear weapons. In this hypothetical scenario, if country B uses tactical nuclear weapons, country A can't make a proportionate nuclear response. It can only use its strategic nuclear weapons because that's all it's got. So their response would be disproportionate, which means they're making that response is less credible, which means their nuclear deterrence posture has just been undermined, because credibility is essential to your deterrence posture. It's just as important as having a capability. So during the Cold War, there's a lot of discussion about how, in order to deter nuclear weapons at any level, you needed to have the capability to make a proportionate response. As such, the argument went that strategic nuclear weapons were required to deter strategic nuclear weapons. And the same applied to intermediate range nuclear weapons and tactical nukes. So according to Cold War deterrence theory, it's very risky to have an escalation gap because it undermines the credibility of your deterrence posture and increases the chances of nuclear weapons use. As such, if your opponent had intermediate range nuclear missiles, you needed them as well in order to deter them from using theirs. Now, this argument had a lot of impact during the Cold War because NATO was weaker in conventional military terms than the Soviet Union. And in order to compensate for that weakness, NATO governments aimed to have top-notch nuclear forces with no escalation gaps. Now, in contrast, NATO currently has conventional military superiority over Russia, even though Russia can generate local, time-bounded superiority. Although the argument about the necessity of closing escalation gaps still has some advocates, they're nowhere near as strong a lobbying group as they used to be. So when I've been going to meetings with militaries and governments and think tankers in Paris, Washington and London, discussing the collapse of the INF and what's going to happen, you might find maybe one, maybe two people saying, oh yeah, what about escalation gaps? Do we try and go through a dual track approach? But they're not swaying the room. People just aren't as interested anymore because there's not that same reliance on nuclear forces as you had during the Euromissiles crisis. And it basically, the positions of Russia and NATO have reversed since the Cold War. During the Cold War, Soviet imperialism was on the strategic offensive. They're expanding, they're taking territory, they're enjoying conventional superiority, whereas NATO member states are on the strategic defensive. Several member states lost huge swathes of territory, and NATO was conventionally weaker. Today, Russia is on the strategic defensive. Tactically and operationally, they might be on the offensive, but strategically, they are definitely on the defensive. You can look at their actions in Ukraine and Georgia, where they're creating defensive buffer zones to minimize the size of Russia's border with NATO and maintain control over the Black Sea, which they view as essential for their defense of Russia. I mean, they still buzz British and Japanese airspace every day, every other day. It's just to remind us that they exist. I mean, essentially, their economy is the size of Australia. They gained some advantages through purchasing power parity because a lot of stuff's pretty cheap in Russia. But they still have delusions of being a world power, so they make a lot of noise in order to get attention. And they make sure no one forgets about them, because people did forget about them when there was some talk about Georgia joining NATO. It wasn't a mainstream thing, but the conversations were happening. There was some hints about Ukraine getting into NATO at some point in the future, and the Russians were like, no, that's a real red line for us. How dare you have forgotten about us? So they're constantly doing things in order to get attention on them. Because, you know, they're not even close to being a superpower. The only thing that's superpower about them is the fact that they have the most nuclear weapons in the world. So, in contrast, since the end of the Cold War, NATO has been on the strategic offensive. They've expanded. Several members of the Warsaw Pact are now in NATO. And NATO is conventionally stronger than Russia. And because NATO is conventionally stronger, NATO isn't relying on nuclear forces as much, and it cares a lot less about the escalation gap arguments that had so much sway during the lead-up and during the Euromissiles crisis. Now, the second reason I don't think you're going to see a repeat of the Euromissiles crisis is that the dual-track approach, which was the NATO response to the Russian introduction of weapons, the idea that you'll introduce these weapons and then you get rid of them. Now, that requires expenditure. And defense budgets in the US and the UK are far smaller as a percentage of GDP than they used to be. This isn't just because the Cold War ended. The long-term trend in US and British defense spending since the 1950s is that nuclear weapons have enabled extensive cuts in military budgets as a percentage of GDP, as nuclear deterrence took over various functions, previously performed by conventional deterrence and performed these functions at a far lower cost. Currently, military budgets in NATO as a percentage of GDP are less than half of what they were during the Euro missiles crisis. Neither the UK nor the US have the budgetary flexibility to launch major unplanned procurement. They're both struggling to finance their current force structures and their ongoing modernisation and recapitalisation programmes. So they don't want to spend money on something just to throw it away. The second part of the dual track is that you negotiate with the other side. Now, the Russians, they don't have much trust. Well, they're not trusted, essentially. The US, in particular, trusts the Russians less than they trusted the Soviets. I mean, that's really saying something, because the Soviets were extremely duplicitous and brutal as far as their leadership goes. I mean, to be fair, you can't really run a one-party state without being duplicitous and brutal. You have to do regular purges in order to maintain political unity. But even so, the US felt they could do a deal with the Soviets, and they did do deals with the Soviets. But they don't feel that they can trust the current clique that's running Russia. So they don't really see the point in trying to do arms control negotiations with them. There's certainly no point in engaging in a decade-long process of spending money that you want to spend on other things on something just to throw it away in order to get an agreement with a bunch of people you don't trust. So, and you've also got a problem there with how does China fit into any new arms control agreements. Russia has explicitly said if we're going to have a new arms control agreement, it can't just be between Russia and between the US. You've got to get all the countries that have nuclear weapons involved in these discussions. And that's going to be very tricky. I mean, I can't even imagine whether Israel would even agree to turn up, because they're still, you know, pretending they don't have anything. So essentially, there's not enough interest in either track of the dual track approach. Now, the third reason I don't think there'll be a Euro missiles crisis is that, as mentioned earlier, governments massively underestimated and were surprised by the level of public protest during the Euro missiles crisis. I think there was one minister in the UK cabinet who expected protests. All the other ministers were surprised. And what really surprised them was that it wasn't just an extreme fringe that was protesting. There was a huge swathe of middle England that supported the protests. And that's a real issue for any democratic government. And the protests weren't just a problem for the Euro missiles, for these intermediate range forces. They were threatening the entire nuclear enterprise. It really gave a huge boost to the nuclear abolitionist movement, as mentioned earlier. And it was, at one point in time, it was threatening the procurement of Trident missile systems, and it was placing Vanguard submarines under threat as well. So right now, governments in NATO genuinely believe that a missile deployment similar to the Euro missiles would lead to similar kind of protests. Regardless of whether or not that's true, that's what their perception is. And it's pretty much the first thing that the British or the German delegates will say when people are talking about the collapse of the INF is, we really don't want to do anything that's going to bring back these massive protests. They're just not into it at all. And it's very, very live in their decision-making. Literally the first thing they think of. None of the governments in NATO want to see a revival of the radical nuclear abolitionist movements in their countries. They all want to maintain the nuclear status quo. And this links with quite a common phenomenon in politics, where maintaining the status quo is fairly easy, whereas pushing through change is pretty hard. And this is partly because you get winners and losers with change, and the losers often mobilize to resist change. And generally speaking, the larger the change, the greater the resistance. For example, you have a recent request by the US military for nuclear air-launched and sea-launched cruise missiles. And that's quite a change from their current nuclear systems of gravity bombs and ballistic missiles. If money in the US wasn't as tight, they might have got it. But money is tight in the US, and you know they didn't get any approval in order to be able to do it. However, because it's new, and they're like, well, why do you need it? You've just told us, and you've told us for years, that our current systems are the ultimate insurance policy against extreme threats. Well, why do you need this new thing? However, it's relatively easy to get a renewal of something that's already there. And you see that in the US and you see that in the UK. So the UK renewal of the nuclear deterrent, the replacement of four Vanguard submarines with four dreadnoughts, I mean, that was supported by landslide victories in Parliament on three occasions in recent years. And you have a lot of continuity there. You have four Resolution-class submarines replaced by four Vanguard-class submarines, which will be replaced by four Dreadnought-class submarines, and they're all carrying ballistic missiles with nuclear warheads. Now, the fourth and final reason is that Europe has reduced in strategic importance since the Euro missiles crisis, which was also alluded to earlier. Europe was the, in many ways, the center of global politics in the 20th century. Europe was the heart of the de facto Soviet empire. It was where communists and capitalists faced each other across a really long border. But now, China is a far greater concern for the US than Europe. And the US is trying to pivot to the Pacific, and European deployments are essentially economy of force deployments. They are often part of the quid pro quo. So, for example, Poland refused to get involved in any US adventures, again, unless the US deployed more US troops to Poland, because the Poles are really, really concerned about Russia. So the Americans sent a deployment, and now Poland's back on board with going on US-led adventures around the world. But it's the Americans are trying to do as little as they can, essentially. And where they would probably want to deploy the new intermediate range missiles they're developing, it's probably going to be focusing on China, and they're going to want to put conventional warheads on them, not nuclear warheads. And that's in order to reinforce their conventional deterrence posture vis-a-vis China, as and when required, probably to deploy it in the lead-up to a crisis, various islands around the South China Sea. And that would cause a real problem with the Chinese Navy, essentially. And the advantages of these ground launch cruise missile systems compared to air launch or sea launch is that they're cheaper and they're more resilient. And you can have really large magazines if you do some pre-deployment. It's a system that has advantages. And they can't do that deployment if they send them to Europe and if they give them nuclear warheads instead of conventional. So to summarize, I don't think there'll be a new Euro missiles crisis because NATO is conventionally stronger than Russia. And this conventional military strength has decreased the importance of nuclear weapons within NATO's strategy. The US doesn't want to go down either track of a dual-track approach. They don't want to buy something just to throw it away. And they trust the Russians less than they trusted the Soviets. Thirdly, none of the governments in NATO want to see large-scale anti-nuclear protests. None of them want to provoke protests by deploying nuclear neuromissiles, missiles, intermediate-range missiles. None of them want to see the revival of radical nuclear abolitionist movements within their countries. They're quite happy with keeping things as it is. Fourthly, Europe is not as important to US strategy as it used to be. China has replaced Europe as the main concern for US policymakers. If the US deploys intermediate-range ground-launch cruise missiles, it will be with conventional warheads, not nuclear, at least initially, but probably permanently. And the most likely location for that deployment will be islands around the South China Sea, not Europe.
Thank you for those three very interesting talks. I think, firstly, we should note that there seems to be some consensus that there won't be a Euro missile crisis. So this is some good news. But there's also some concerns about deployments in Asia or something like this. So it's somewhat mixed news. Perhaps you might want to respond to each other briefly, and then we have about 20 minutes for Q&A as well. So there's a lot of notes taking as well. If you want to make any comments about each other's talks, this is an opportunity, yes.
I broadly agree with what the other two speakers have said. So I'd be more keen to get some questions
very
from the
good.
Audience. But I'll
well, just one on just one very quick point. I'm very pleased to hear from Sam about the concerns about popular protest, and just one thing to throw in of the NATO war. Missiles currently located across Europe. There used to be a number of them held in East Anglia at RAF Lakenheath, and we kept on protesting there. And in fact, we protested there apparently for longer than the missiles were retained there, because we read in the SIPRI yearbook from Hans Christensen that in 2008 those nuclear warheads had been withdrawn and relocated somewhere else because of the concern about the scale of UK anti-war and anti-nuclear protests. So, of course, we were very delighted, even if for a couple of years we'd actually been protesting at a site without nuclear weapons. So I guess that what you're saying is correct.
Yeah, I don't have any major comments on either of the other two presentations. I concur with the chair that there's seems to be a lot of agreement on what the main issues are, which is a nice surprise since we all developed our speeches independently.
Yes,
it's quite planned. Nice when you turn up and everyone's in agreement.
Okay, very good. Okay, let's hear the audience. Yes, we have microphones. I see two questions. Let's take two together to start. Yes. You might address the panel or an individual speaker if you wish.
Hello?
Hello.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Is it on? Good. I think one reason why these missiles will not be deployed in Europe, which hasn't been mentioned, is a technological change. I mean, in the early 60s, you had intermediate-range ballistic missiles deployed in Europe, and they were removed after a few years because they were replaced by intercontinental ballistic missiles, which could be located in the continental United States. Now, 20 years later, we had the deployment of cruise missiles. Now, they weren't removed because they became obsolete. They were removed for political reasons. But that was a long time ago, and things have changed. And I think the more likely scenario is they will develop long-range cruise missiles. And in fact, the indications are the Russians are doing that already. There was an accident in Siberia, which is widely linked with the development of those missiles. And the Americans, if they see the necessary, would follow suit, because it's far more convenient from their point of view not to be reliant on these sort of forward deployment of these systems, which lay them open to all these sort of protests and are vulnerable in many ways.
Right. Technology, that's a really good one. Let's have one more question, because that was for the panel.
Thank you. A professor from China and now a teaching fellow at the IGA, Institute of Global Affairs. My question is about U.S. force, including the new nuclear weapon and China's rise. Yeah, yes. If we look at the world, it is easy to conclude that if there's a war, there's USA. And actually, it's like that. When China was the number one great power, such as the Ming Dynasty, we sent the biggest ship into the West. But it's a friendship. When Britain became the first great power, the Great Britain sent China the warship. When now U.S. became the great power, the number one great power, he mean that the U.S. sent to the East not only the warship, but atom bomb, nuclear weapons as well. My question is that does the U.S. force make the world safer or more dangerous? Does the China's rise, will the China's rise make the world safer or more dangerous? Thank you.
Very good question. All right, let's go each in order as we presented. So first on the changes in technology, and second on the implications of China's rise.
Sure. Well, on the technological aspect, I think Sam may be the best qualified to answer that.
Yes.
That's key as well. So I'll reserve my I'll pass on sure. Answering that one. As for whether the U.S. makes the world a safer or less safe place, I think that's perhaps beyond my remit as well. But clearly, I think. I mean, there are ongoing debates over, particularly regarding nuclear weapons, of whether this actually increases security or whether it inherently makes things less safe. And I think it would be a minority view to think that deploying new nuclear weapons to East Asia would be a good thing. I think that would ratchet up tensions and certainly make the region and consequently the world a less safe place. So perhaps I'll leave it at that, but regarding broader U.S. policy.
Kate, yes.
Okay, so I'm going to leave the technological question to Sam, too. But thank you for your comments and question. I think that the United States' determination to retain its global superpower or single global superpower status and its dominance, I think, is a very dangerous development. And I think, well, some of the kind of policies that I outlined earlier on indicate that. And, of course, I think many people hope for not even going to a kind of two superpower situation, but to go to a multipolar world, you know. And I think a few years ago it seemed as though that was the development that was taking place. But President Trump's assertion of America first as a policy, I think, pulls back from that. And even though he talks of kind of, you know, withdrawing the United States from the kind of international sphere, that is clearly not the case. In terms of China's role, I suppose over the years we have noticed a number of things. For example, that China has a no first use policy with regard to nuclear weapons. It has consistently sought a Paris Treaty, prevention of the arms race in outer space, to counter and kind of mitigate the dangers of missile defense developments, and indeed space policy developments. And of course, that's something that President Trump is pursuing very rigorously now, the kind of development of a U.S. space policy, because he wants to be U.S. America first in space and to have that kind of dominance. So that's dangerous as well. One of the things we've always noticed was that China has had a very small nuclear arsenal. I think it's maybe the same size as the French nuclear arsenal, perhaps. You know, that means no nuclear arsenal is acceptable, but in compared to its standing in the world and so on, it has a very, very small nuclear arsenal. And our one of the reasons for that could be that China did not wish to get caught up in the same kind of destructive and costly nuclear arms race that the Soviet Union got caught up in, you know, which contributed to its demise because of the negative economic impact of that. Of course, we see now that China is developing its nuclear arsenal, you know, and so on. So that would be, in my opinion, a very unfortunate step if China thinks, you know, that it has to develop and get more nuclear weapons and be a greater nuclear power. You know, that's not necessary for China to go down that route. You know, its strength is in its industrial and economic development, and it's raising so many millions of people out of poverty, for example, those kinds of social and economic developments. So I very much hope that China won't go down the road of sort of massive development of nuclear weapons.
Okay, so in terms of the technology question, there are a few bits of tech that the US military have requested funding for, and it's been turned down. So as mentioned earlier, US military requested air launch nuclear cruise missiles, and they were told, no, you can stick with your gravity bombs. They also wanted to have sea launch nuclear cruise missiles, and were told, no, you can have a smaller warhead for Trident. And that, you know, which has some issues, which I'm not going to go into, in terms of how people see your response. Actually, I will go into it. So if you fire off an intercontinental ballistic missile, there's no way for the people watching you and who have just been alerted to the fact that you've made a launch. They don't know that it's a low-yield warhead or whether it's got multiple warheads in there that are all at about 100 kiloton yield. So it's quite tricky for people to know what's coming in and therefore how they should respond. And that's why the US wanted to have the nuclear cruise missile option, because then it's quite clear that it's a smaller yield weapon. The advantage of not having nuclear warheads on your cruise missiles is that when you fire a cruise missile, everyone knows it's conventional, which means it's far more usable in that sense. Although the whole dual use issue isn't necessarily a problem for, say, the stealth bombers, because they can drop nuclear payloads as well as conventional payloads. Well, the point is that, yeah, there is some tech that maybe the US military could use, but they're spending their money on lots of other things. They've got a very ambitious modernization program at the moment, which is focusing on command, control, communications in order to really join up their forces. And they think it'll be a massive force multiplier, but it's taking a lot of money. And the US military has been under a huge amount of strain in the last few years. I mean, they haven't managed to sort out their maintenance properly. They're not able to generate as many fast jets as they would like. They have quite a few aircraft carriers, but they can only have three out at any one time. They could maybe surge to four or at a real stretch five, because their maintenance is, there's a backlog there, because they haven't been able to get the funding in order to be able to deal with it. So for the first time in quite a while, there's various bits of technology that the US could go down that route, but they're deciding not to. They're deciding not to fund it. And we also have to remember that right now, US government spends more money on healthcare than it does on the military. And that's a huge change since the end of the Cold War. So I can't really see them going down the route of getting approval for funding for long-range nuclear cruise missiles. So I think the intermediate-range cruise missiles that they're developing, they will stay conventional, because they really want to beef up their conventional deterrence posture. In terms of, US forces make the world more dangerous, or do they make it safer? It's a really tricky dilemma. It's a really, really tricky question, because on the one hand, if you're trying to have a credible conventional deterrence posture, you need to say you're willing to go to war, and you need to be able to win that war. There are certain risks with that, but there are also risks in having a really weak military and essentially giving people the green light to do whatever they want to do in the international realm. So there's pros and cons for having a strong military as well as having a weak military. You know, neither option is risk-free. Neither option is completely safe. So in many ways, it's impossible to answer the question as to, does a US force make the world safer or more dangerous? It's a point made by General Carl von Clausewitz that warfare more closely than any other human activity most closely resembles a game of cards. There's a lot of chance involved. You know, a gambit that might have a good chance of working, maybe it just doesn't work that time, and you end up in a conflict that you're trying to avoid. So it's a really tricky situation. Certainly, I think it's quite useful for permanent allies of the US, for the US to have a lot of military strength. It's quite useful for other NATO member states. It's quite useful for their informal allies as well.
Good. Let's see some further questions. One here. Let's come back here. Yes. Do you think there's a danger with the fact that there's potentially some sort of ritual and residual military strategy around, in the sense that there's military exercises along Russia's border, there's talk of a new Cold War today, and there's still residual systems like NATO material in the form of nuclear weapons from the Cold War and the memory of the Cold War that makes the psychological context easier to slip back into a kind of strategic reality where having that kind of standoff that we've talked about is easier than it was perhaps the first time around.
Fascinating. Shall we go straight into this?
Yeah, I'd quite like to jump in on that. I'm not sure how much residual memory there is. My main issue with the US at the conferences I'm going to is that they've completely forgotten nuclear deterrence theory, quite a lot of them. So the kind of stuff that was real bread and butter for McNamara and for Kissinger, the Americans I'm talking to, they've never heard of it. You know, it's like showing fire to a caveman. And that's a real issue. So I don't think there's that much residual memory there. So I wouldn't view that as a risk. I would say the bigger risk is that they've completely forgotten about deterrence. And deterrence rests on mutual vulnerability. You know, that's the key point that Kissinger made and McNamara made. The Americans aren't interested in mutual vulnerability. And a couple of conferences I've been to, you'll get a Brit saying, we need to have mutual vulnerability. And you'll get an American turning around and saying, yeah, we don't really believe in that.
We believe in them being vulnerable and us being dominant. And it's like, well, that's not a particularly safe situation if you've got the Americans saying, we want dominance, and the Russians saying, we want dominance, and maybe the Chinese saying, we want dominance. Like, that's not healthy. You know, that's an issue. So I would say the problem is that, you know, people have just forgotten all of this history from the Cold War.
Yes, I mean, I largely agree with that. Just put me in mind of when the United States began to change, or when I observed it beginning to change and kind of pulling away from the mad, you know, mutually assured destruction approach, in 2002, when President Bush pulled out of the ABM treaty. You know, that was the kind of first big treaty withdrawal, and the ABM treaty had assured that the kind of strategic parity between the US and the Soviet Union and then subsequently Russia would be maintained. And of course, pulling out of it, he pulled out of it in order to be able to develop the missile defense systems, which have done so much to undermine that kind of mutually assured destruction thing. I mean, we've never supported or agreed with the mutually assured destruction thing, but it has a logic to it, and it is safer to have the kind of none of us want to go there. You know, it's a safer thing than a country as the United States is now doing, which talks about usable nuclear weapons and, you know, doesn't have that approach to non-use, you know, which is the kind of consensus that would never be used. Pulling away from that now is intensely dangerous.
Yeah, just to broadly agree, and I think particularly Sam's point is quite useful, that much of the residual memory is not so much going back to the 1980s or even earlier, but perhaps more to the 1990s and early 2000s, of this kind of the so-called unipolar moment, when the United States did feel that it was dominant, and in many ways it was. And I think potentially the real danger is that the United States pursues that kind of policy when it no longer actually matches the reality on the ground.
I saw a hand right in the back. Yes.
Hi. So I note the panel agreed that we're not heading towards a repeat of the old Euro missile crisis. My question is, is there a risk, though, that we're headed to a new version of that crisis if, as a result of Russia's breach of the INF and deployment of new missile systems, NATO isn't seen to react in some way? Is there a new kind of crisis that results out of that, out of you know, Eastern European countries seeing that there's no reaction, no willingness from other partners to step up and take measures? And if there is a risk of that sort of crisis emerging, what should Europe/NATO do about it?
Right. Okay, I'd like to jump in on that one. The INF essentially died 5 years ago. We've just had the funeral recently, but it was, you know, it's been dead for a while. So in terms of Eastern Europe, their big concerns aren't the nuclear weapons. Their big concerns are little green men, hybrid warfare, gray zone, conventional capabilities. And what really got them concerned was the Donbass war and the annexation of Crimea. So you've had deployments to the Baltics and to Poland, the enhanced forward presence, primarily to calm them down. It wasn't because, you know, the UK and the US thought that the Russians were actually seriously going to invade. It's just because we wanted to reassure our allies. We believed that our conventional and nuclear deterrent was credible, and the Russians believed it. And the Russians didn't have any particular interest in going into the Baltics, particularly because they've just upgraded their facilities at St. Petersburg, so they don't need the Baltics, really. They don't need those ports. So I wouldn't say the nuclear thing is a massive issue for Eastern Europe. They're more worried about the conventional aspects. And there has been a NATO response, which is, we're going to improve our intelligence capability, we're going to improve our missile defenses, and we're going to spend more money on defense. For the US, that's quite a good result in many ways, because they've been trying for a long time to get various free riders in continental Europe to pay more money on defense. So I don't think you'll have a nuclear dimension. I think what you'll see is an increase in defense spending. But I don't think it's going to be massive. You know, I don't think it's going to be enough. I don't think you could call it an arms race. I mean, no one's got the money to do arms races at the moment. That's where I think things will go.
I'll return to the point you made earlier on, you know, about Russia is strategically on the defensive, generally speaking, whereas NATO is really on the up and up, so to speak. I mean, if you look at sort of replacement and modernization of nuclear forces, Russia is still struggling to modernize or renew or upgrade its Soviet-era nuclear weapons. You know, I think they're kind of 70% through the process or something like that. I mean, Britain is on its entering into its second post-Cold War nuclear weapons system. You know, so I think that's the kind of reality of the balance.
A very good question. I think, yes, I mean, the real danger is what if Russia were to deploy some kind of new, the next generation, of a couple of generations on by now, of SS-20s, right? NATO would need to respond in some way. But I think, for the reasons that we discussed, it's probably not very probable that Russia would do this, in part expecting the kinds of consequences that NATO would need to take. But NATO would need to take some sort of response. And I think that is an open question. If hypothetically Russia were to deploy INF in Western Russia, what would the NATO response be? I think they would much prefer to keep it to a conventional response. But clearly the Baltic states and Poland in particular would be very uncomfortable with the thought of new Russian INF.
Yes, right here.
So thank you for your talk. It was really interesting. So my question to you is that, do you believe that the fact that today the world is very globalized and our economies are like very much interconnected in so many different ways, like the Western economy, but also that of China and the Global South and the rest of the world, do you think that has had like an impact on like the importance of nuclear weapons, making them like less important and less relevant? And do you think that the trade wars today are what we should be more concerned about as like an ongoing issue, because it seems to have like a very direct impact on the daily livelihood of people?
Very good. Interdependence. We're just about at time, so perhaps the last couple of questions, if there's any others, we'll take them together. Yes? Yeah? Okay. It's a good one to end on.
I'd say nuclear weapons are a curious one, because I mean they haven't been used since World War II. They haven't been used for over 70 years. But the consequences of their use is so massive that people are still legitimately concerned about it. Whereas economic warfare happens the whole time. Sanctions are happening the whole time, pretty extreme sanctions as well. I'd say, if I wasn't a U.S. ally, if I wasn't in the U.K. and the U.K. wasn't a U.S. ally, I would be a lot more worried about U.S. sanctions than it would be about the U.S. launching a nuclear weapon at me. Because sanctions are real and they're happening the whole time.
I agree with your overall thing about, inter-economic cooperation and so on, potential for cooperating more closely and all that sort of thing, that's enhanced by that. I think one of the great dangers at the moment is we are seeing the rise of nationalism, and of course the trade war between the US and China is the result of the America First policy, which is the result of a kind of interlinked with a kind of surge of nationalist sentiment, and we're seeing that kind of nationalism on an increasing level, and we're seeing economic nationalism and so on as well, kind of arguments 10 years ago would have been completely out of the question, and those kind of orientations, the rise of the far right going alongside the nationalism thing, those are incredibly dangerous, really very dangerous indeed. And I would just draw people's attention to the doomsday clock, which you may know about. Every year the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists make their assessment of how close we are to, as a species, to annihilation. And for the last 2 years, the hands of the doomsday clock have been set at 2 minutes to midnight. And in fact, they've never been closer than that. Even during the Cold War, they were only ever at 2 minutes to midnight, I think, in 1953. You know, so these scientists, you know, great experts, see us in an incredibly dangerous place, you know, and they see the twin existential threats of climate change and nuclear weapons. You know, one of the things around nuclear weapons is kind of careless rhetoric and kind of escalation of tensions and all this kind of thing, unthinking stuff, which perhaps in the past states would have been more careful about how they relate to other countries. You know, but the rise of fake news, cyber warfare, the possibility for kind of nuclear use by accident almost, you know, is much, much greater risk than it has been perhaps at any point. So I think even though, of course, it's marvellous that they haven't been used again since 1945, you know, but we should never think that because they haven't been used for a long time that they will not be used again.
So thanks for your question, and absolutely, I think we've seen a worsening of international relationships in recent years. And countries are, particularly the US, but other countries as well, are far more willing to launch a trade war than a nuclear war. And I think, as devastating as trade wars are, if those are the options, then clearly a trade war is the lesser evil. But this does seem to be the favoured tool. And so I think what I'm saying is that it's worth keeping this in context. And so that it's a trade war is better than a nuclear war, but clearly both are worth avoiding. Mm.
One thing I'd like to jump on there, the doomsday clock. It's a little bit, it is true that it's closer to midnight than it has been at any other point. But part of that's because they only set the time on the doomsday clock every year. So you had the Cuban Missile Crisis occurred and finished in between them setting the clocks. So it was certainly a lot riskier during the Cuban Missile Crisis than anything else that we've seen since. You had Soviet submarine captains screaming at their crew to ready the nuclear torpedo and being talked out of it by their second-in-command and crazy situations. And also because of the level of DEFCON that the US was at, when they scrambled some of their fighters in order to protect a spy plane that had wandered into Soviet territory, the Soviet scrambled fighters in order to try and intercept this plane, the US planes had nuclear-armed air-to-air missiles, which there's no actual, way of stopping them from firing them if they wanted to. Yeah, in theory, they need authorization, but they could have just fired it. Now, that is a really risky situation where you could quite easily have had the use of tactical nuclear weapons, and that could have completely changed the way that crisis panned out. And that's just because the whole thing happened. And then people didn't actually realize how dangerous it was until a lot later. But also, when it came to setting the doomsday clock, they're like, well, yeah, that was pretty risky, but it's over now. So we're not going to put it really close to midnight.
All right. That's just about time. I'd like to thank everyone for joining us this evening for your actually quite good questions. I was quite pleased with that in our discussion. I'd like to thank LSE and the LSE Events team as well at LSE Ideas. And lastly, to our speakers, thanks again.
Very good.